I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. This past Friday, President-elect Joe Biden laid out an ambitious plan to address the COVID-19 crisis that has led to more than 400,000 deaths and upended the economy. Here, in a nutshell, is what he proposed: 100 million vaccinations in 100 days.
Our plan is as clear as it is bold. Get more people vaccinated for free. Create more places for them to get vaccinated. Mobilize more medical teams to get the shots in people's arms. Increase supply and get it out the door as soon as possible. This will be one of the most challenging operational efforts ever undertaken by our country. But you have my word that we will manage the hell out of this operation.
Biden said the vaccine rollout has been a dismal failure so far and told anti-maskers in Congress to grow up and wear a mask. In fact, he's reportedly going to announce a mask mandate on federal property. Joining us is Alice Miranda Olstein. She's healthcare and transition reporter for Politico. Alice Miranda Olstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, you can join us. We're kind of marching through several different challenges facing the Biden-Harris administration. We're focusing on the pandemic, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times with any questions or comments. Alice, what can you tell us about this mask mandate that the president-elect is reportedly going to issue?
Yes, so this is something that he was talking about on the campaign trail and throughout the transition, but we now know that one of his first acts after being sworn in is to sign an executive order creating a mask mandate on the spaces that the federal government can control. So that means interstate travel. That means in all federal buildings, both here in Washington, D.C. and across the country. He's also going to be pressuring governors who are still holding out on issuing their own mask mandates to do so. And that is a lot less certain.
Well, and that would then apply to the U.S. Congress, correct?
Yes, although recently the House just passed its own. They already have a mask requirement, but obviously, as you mentioned and as you had in the clip, people have been flouting it. Members, Republican members, have been flouting that requirement. And so they recently voted to impose fines on people who don't wear masks. We've had a lot of outbreaks on Capitol Hill.
Indeed. Well, let's talk about what the vice president-elect laid out in that very short clip, the idea of figuring out how to get vaccines into arms. This is the new phrase, I think, that I hear being used to talk about a vaccination program. How will he increase the places where people can get a vaccine?
Yes. So the folks on Biden's team who I've spoken to really are hammering the importance of opening up vaccination sites that aren't just at hospitals and pharmacies, as they mostly are now, because a lot of lower income neighborhoods, neighborhoods of color, don't have a hospital or pharmacy nearby. And if people are not able to travel, then that really limits who can access the vaccine, even when it is their turn for their age group or their job category or what have you. And so they're planning to open up vaccination sites in sports stadiums, churches, community centers, schools, potentially, you know, looking at places where people are going anyways and where they can easily get access. They also need to have more people doing the vaccinations. You know, we're having severe health worker shortages throughout our system right now. And so they're looking at broadening who can give a vaccine. You know, you don't necessarily need a medical degree to be able to give a vaccine. Lots of people with different health conditions give themselves injections every day. So looking at how they can train more folks to really create, you know, an army of public health workers to get this done.
We're hearing about, I don't know whether vaccine shortage is the correct description, but there were supposed to be vaccines in reserve, and now we're learning that there are not vaccines in reserve. What can you tell us, Alice, about just how many vaccines are either out there or waiting in reserve?
So there are tens of millions that have been out there, and many have not actually gotten into arms because what we're hearing is that there just hasn't been enough focus on the so-called last mile. There's been a lot on how to develop the vaccine, ship it out to the states, and then the Trump administration's attitude has sort of been, now it's the state's problem. And the states have really been struggling with limited funding and limited personnel, like I said, to set up that last mile to get it to folks, especially in these harder-to-reach neighborhoods. And so there is going to be a lot more focus from the Biden administration on federal support for that last mile. And yes, there are issues with the supply. They are hoping to ramp that up. They are hoping to use the federal government's powers to compel production, not only of the vaccine itself, but all of the supplies necessary to get it to people, the vials, the needles, the PPE, the gloves and masks for the people doing the vaccinations, to make sure that no supply shortage is a barrier in this effort.
Clearly an ambitious plan is 100 million vaccines in 100 days, or I guess 50 million people in 100 days. Is that doable from your reporting?
So the pace of vaccinations has been ramping up. It is going to get close to 1 million a day, even before Biden takes over. So we are hearing that it is possible. And, you know, the initial lags and confusion that we saw, some of which are getting addressed now. And the hope is that by setting up these mega vaccination sites in places like sports stadiums, they can really process a lot more people per day than we're seeing right now.
We're hearing stories of people, in a sense, jumping the line, people that are, you know, not first responders or healthcare workers getting vaccinated when maybe their turn was actually a couple of months from now. Does the incoming Biden administration do anything about that?
So that's a really interesting dilemma that I have been reporting on. And there's a lot of tension because obviously people don't want line jumping to happen. They want to discourage it. They worry that if it happens and it's, you know, people see it happening, then people will lose faith in the process and get discouraged and think, oh, you know, rich people are just going to scoop it all up. However, there's a fear that if the government imposes restrictions that are too strict, you know, checking multiple forms of ID at the vaccination sites or things like that, that can slow things down even further and lead to a situation like we've seen in some areas with really strict requirements like New York, where vaccines were wasted or left in the freezer instead of getting into people's arms. So there's a feeling that, yes, we want to discourage line jumping. We want to tell people to wait their turn, but the Biden administration says they're more focused on getting to the disadvantaged communities and making sure they have access than really cracking down on people with privilege trying to pull strings.
Does this plan have any ways of dealing with vaccine hesitancy? And we are hearing that a good portion of the population is just not ready to stand in line to get a vaccine. What does the incoming Biden administration want to do about that?
Yes, that's an issue that is absolutely on their radar, and they are looking, we reported last week that they are looking at creating a more than 1 billion public ad campaign to get the message out to people that, you know, this is something they should trust and something they should do for themselves and their loved ones, and to get the country back to normal. You know, the faster we all get vaccinated, the faster we can get back to work and gather in groups again. And they are hoping that through a combination of, you know, ad campaigns on TV, radio, digital, and also, you know, tapping trusted community members in lots of different communities and tailoring messages to different communities, that they can really address some of this. But it's absolutely a problem, even, you know, in the first tier of people getting vaccinated, which is healthcare workers, we're even seeing a lot of hesitancy there, I think more than people expected.
How would you say this pandemic team that that Biden has put together, how does that compare to Trump's task force having to do with the pandemic?
So the Biden message has overwhelmingly for months been that they're going to follow the science. And so the people that they have tapped to run this are people who are medical experts, epidemiologists, global health experts, really people who come from that background. And we're going to see a lot of less of what we've seen in the Trump administration, where people who mostly work on politics and economics are having a large say in this. And it's going to be much more weighted to medical experts and public health.
I read that this is something like the price tag is something like $400 billion or $415 billion. Do they have to get this through Congress?
Yes, a lot of it does have to go through Congress. And what you mentioned is part of this bigger $1.9 trillion bill that they are proposing that includes both things on the healthcare side and things on the economic side. Of course, those are inextricably tied together. The attitude of the incoming Biden administration is that we can't rescue the economy without fully dealing with the pandemic, whereas the Trump administration sort of saw those two things in conflict with one another. And so this is absolutely going to have to move through Congress. Both Biden and some of his Democratic allies in Congress say they would prefer to do it in a bipartisan way, but sources tell us they are not going to wait around forever, and they will be ready to move using reconciliation and passing it just with Democratic votes if necessary.
And what are the plans for boosting testing and boosting contact tracing?
Yes, absolutely. So even as vaccination is, the big headline right now and the way that experts say will lead to the end of the pandemic, they don't want testing and contact tracing to get left behind. And so there are tens of millions of dollars for both in this bill that's been proposed. And as I mentioned on vaccinations, there's this hope of creating this public health worker core of at least 100,000 people. And they can work on contact tracing. They can work on vaccinations. Later they can work on tutoring school kids to help catch up after falling behind during distance learning. The hope is that this core of workers can really be used for whatever states need most going forward. There's also provisions in the bill to subsidize the health insurance of people who lost their jobs because of the pandemic, keeping them on the rolls so they're not uninsured at this very precarious time. And it's really striking to me that, they are trying to get Republicans on board and say that they want this to happen, but they are also very much signaling that they are going to be ready to move with or without them.
And final question, we get about 30 seconds. There is a ceremony tonight at 5:30 acknowledging the fact that we have lost more than 400,000 people to this pandemic.
Yes. So it's really the sort of somber tone that the Biden administration is striking and, his talk of how we are going through a dark winter and things are going to get worse before they get better. That is such a contrast from a lot of the happy talk that we've heard under the Trump administration and promises that COVID will just go away. And so I think there's a real attempt now to acknowledge the pain people are feeling and the loss, that we've seen and rally for the fight ahead.
Well, we have to leave it there. Alice Miranda Olsen, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's healthcare reporter for Politico. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Today on Radio Times, we are previewing President-elect Joe Biden's plans to address the pandemic, the economy, and climate once he takes office tomorrow. Last week, he outlined a $1.9 trillion economic stimulus and pandemic relief package to address these twin crises, saying the health of the nation is at stake and does not come cheaply.
During this pandemic, millions of Americans, through no fault of their own, have lost the dignity and respect that comes with a job and a paycheck.
Our guest, Jim Tankersley, who covers economics and tax policy for the New York Times, wrote this week about whether Biden and his advisors had learned the lessons of the Great Recession of 2009 when Biden was vice president. Tankersley's book is titled The Riches of the Land, The Untold Story of America's Middle Class. And Jim Tankersley, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, you can join us by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You know, looking at this $1.9 trillion package where the incoming Biden administration is making this connection between the pandemic and the economy, how much does that break from what the Trump administration had been doing?
Well, there's two big breaks here, I think. The first, as the Biden team has sort of laid out in the last week or so, is that they feel like they've learned the lessons of some Trump administration shortcomings in the last 10 months. And in particular, what they are trying to do is sort of finish the job of what the initial economic rescue package almost a year ago set out to do, which was basically two things. You got to get the virus under control, and then you've got to help vulnerable people and businesses survive until it is under control. And neither of those things came to pass in the last 10 months. The virus, of course, is not under control by any stretch of the imagination. And a lot of help ran out for a lot of people. You know, some of it was renewed in December in the sort of next big stimulus bill that Congress did. But the fear here among a lot of Biden aides is that there's not going to be enough bridge again to last the people and the businesses who might otherwise be evicted or go hungry or, you know, have to close in the case of a business, because there's just going to be several more months to get a vaccine out and into the country and really reignite economic activity in the way that it was before the pandemic hit. So the philosophy here is spend a lot of money trying to get that vaccine out, trying to do testing and tracing to get the virus under control, and then spend a lot more money to keep people and businesses intact while we wait for that success in controlling the virus to happen.
Well, let me go through some of the plans being outlined. One is $1,400 in direct payments. This would be then on top of the $600 that was passed by Congress. Who gets this money?
So that's going to be a big question. The way that the original round of direct payments went, it was limited to people who were essentially sort of lower income and middle class. A bill that Democrats wrote to try to up the checks from $600 in December to $2,000 would have expanded that to a much broader universe of people, past the upper middle class and well into sort of the lower ranks of high earners, if you will, in the country, easily the top quartile of the country. And that's going to be a big fight, I think, in Congress. That a lot of how expensive this program might be depends on just how widespread are these checks. And that's, you know, that's going to be the cost is an issue even for some Democrats. And so that's going to be a real question. Of course, the other thing, though, is that this is very politically popular. That's why it's in the package. They had real success campaigning on checks in the Georgia Senate elections. And so you might look for Democrats to try to keep that to a very wide universe of people because people like getting money and,
sure,
and they want to appeal to them politically.
And looking through a number of the other plans, and it does seem a little more tailored to those who have really been hit hard by the pandemic, whether it has to do with child care tax credits or rental assistance or, you know, protecting people from eviction. I'm just looking at a list here, restoration of the emergency paid leave, money for states and schools. I mean, it seems like it is directed for those who have really been hit harder or hardest by the pandemic. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that most of the rest of the bill is designed to do that, especially at the lower end. I mean, and in some interesting ways, it's really trying to help very low-income, impoverished people, people who are struggling with food insecurity right now. There are things like a child tax credit and an expanded child tax credit, expanded earned income tax credit that are essentially anti-poverty programs, and that are going to be put in place for a year if the Biden plan is passed into law. Those are targeted at the people who have been really hurt. Things like school reopening, the Biden team argues, are also targeted to help workers. If you send a lot of money to schools, you can help the parents, particularly women, who have been forced to go part-time or not go to work at all because they have to stay at home with young children who are doing virtual learning. So they're trying to target relief to get more workers back into the workforce. Obviously, the big contrast to this is the checks. They are not well targeted. The research from the first round of them showed that a lot of them were saved, not spent. And so that is the trade-off here. You have a very politically popular, not targeted thing, along with a bunch of very targeted other proposals.
You wrote an interesting article this week about, back in, 2009, seems like, centuries ago, but nonetheless, a little more than a decade ago, Joe Biden comes in as vice president as the economy was tanking, losing hundreds and hundreds of jobs, it seems like, almost every day. And here he is coming in as president of the United States and facing, obviously, a very serious economic crisis tied to a health crisis. Did the incoming Biden administration, did they learn some lessons from the 2009 Great Recession and what the Obama administration did to address it?
Yeah, they did. And I think it's fair to say that both the team that came in, which includes several veterans of the Obama administration, and Democrats as a whole have learned one really big lesson, which is they think it's better to go too big with a package than not big enough. And it's interesting that the dynamics here are kind of reversed. In 2009, the crisis was spiraling and getting much worse than people had thought. So in the fall, Democrats had thought, maybe Obama would need a couple $100 billion of stimulus to shore up the economy. By the time they took office in 2009, some economists were telling them they needed more than $1 trillion. And the administration basically concluded that was not politically feasible. And so they went for less than $1 trillion. And there are many economists who believe the sort of lack of money in that less ambitious proposal held back the recovery for years to come. And we definitely saw a lot of slow growth coming out of that recession. This time, the economy's gotten a lot of help already, trillions of dollars of help from the government, and it had been improving, although that improvement had been slowing until the end of last year. Now it's sliding into reverse, and so what we see is the Biden administration saying we're going to give another big jolt, and again it's a very different kind of jolt than they did in 2009, right. but it's more than twice as much money, and on top of all the money that's already been spent. And so that is definitely learning a lesson from last time.
And that is Jim Tankersley, who covers economics and tax policy for The New York Times. We are talking about incoming President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion economic stimulus and pandemic relief package. It was unveiled last week. We're talking about how it could be applied and how it will address some of these twin crises that the country faces. And again, you can join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jim, are there deficit hawks that are saying, okay, back in March, Congress passed $900 billion to help the pandemic and the economy. That was $2.2 trillion in March, $900 billion in December, and now as much as $1.9 trillion come 2021. Are there deficit hawks who are basically just, screaming the sky is falling?
I mean, there are certainly Republicans in Congress who resisted previous rounds of aid because of particularly the one in December, because they didn't want it to be more expensive. They didn't want to borrow more money. And we are starting to hear from them again. And I think that you will see Joe Biden struggle to get Republican votes for a package this large, in part because of Republicans are going to be refinding some of the fiscal concerns, deficit concerns that they did not voice, for example, during the first round of pandemic assistance, or even during, you know, the Trump tax cuts debate a few years ago. What's interesting to me, though, is that among the sort of more nonpartisan budget hawks in Washington, there still is a fairly sizable a group of them who say, you know, it's now is the time to deficit spend. We're concerned about deficits. We're concerned about debt. But you need to be doing something to make sure that growth continues, that you get the pandemic under the control, because otherwise the deficit's going to be even worse down the line because the economy is going to crater more. They don't like all the details of this. They in particular don't like the checks, I think, a lot of these groups. But it is not a universal deficit hawks opposing more deficit spending for the recovery here. In fact, it's sort of the opposite.
You know, it seems the pandemic has, or the pandemic economy, whatever you want to call it, has really revealed that there are two Americas, something that you wrote about in your book. And we're seeing that well-off people who often have jobs they can do at home, they're still employed. You know, the stock market has been going gangbusters. I don't really understand why. As the pandemic surges, the stock market thinks that's perfectly okay. But how much do you think we have been shown that we are two Americas and experiencing this pandemic and its economy in such starkly different ways?
Oh, I mean, it's undeniable. I mean, there if you are, you know, an upper middle class or a high earning household with a couple of people who can work from home and who are just continuing to draw your salary, but now suddenly, you know, you can't go out to restaurants or you can't, you know, travel to Europe or whatever you wanted to do over the summer, you might actually find you're sort of swimming in savings now. You're saving a lot more money because there's just you don't have the ability to spend money like you used to on the things you wanted to. Now, that's obviously your preferences have been reduced, as economists would say, but you're doing fine. I mean, it's a great, you know, it's a perfectly fine economic time to be a household like that. But if you are one of the households where you are an essential worker, or you are someone who essentially does not have the choice to work from home, and you've been having to choose between going to work or staying with your kids who can't go to school, if you are, I mean, and this is particularly, you know, workers of color and women of all races are the ones who have been really disproportionately hurt in this, and particularly the ones from the low income spectrum. I mean, this can be a devastating time. And the Federal Reserve apparently has one of the governors of the Fed, Leo Brainard, said last week that Fed researchers have calculated the unemployment rate is like below 5% for high earning Americans, and it's above 20% for low earning Americans.
20%.
And that is just such a stark way of thinking about it.
Does the Biden plan, such as it is, does it address that disparity?
I think that they absolutely are trying to address that disparity. I mean, that is why they are doing these big tax credit expansions for people in poverty. It is why they are trying to really, you know, focus on getting schools reopened. It's in part why they want to up the checks. I mean, that some of the people who will benefit from that, the targeted benefit from that, will come to the people who have lost hours or income. And it's why they've done things like extend unemployment benefits and a supplementary unemployment benefit through September in the proposal, and food stamp benefits. I mean, there's a lot in here for lower income people or people who have lost their jobs in the plan to try to help them get through. And they're trying to think about this in terms of they don't want people going hungry. They don't want these big lines at food banks. And the question is whether, you know, they're doing enough to actually, you know, keep people in their homes and keep them fed and sustained through this tough time.
Oh, such a just a nightmare. What does this plan do for, let's say, retail stores, people that have, you know, small shops? I'm thinking of the restaurants that are, you know, trying to make it through the winter, but, you know, sadly, a lot of them will not. Does this help those people? And I'm also curious about how, you know, how that's going to remake our economy going forward when you don't have that individually owned retail store that's down the street where you can run down and pick up a, you know, pair of socks or something like that.
Right. Well, the last round of stimulus in December re-upped the Paycheck Protection Program, which has been sort of the centerpiece of the government's efforts to try to help small businesses. So that's coming online now. The Trump administration has started to put it in place. It'll be up to the Biden administration to administer it fully. But in the next plan, the Biden plan, there is more targeted help. There's some grants for the hardest hit small businesses, and there is a provision that they want to do more to help restaurants. There's a lot of sort of debate in Congress about what that should be, but plenty of people in Congress want to go really big to help restaurants survive. And I think, look, I think everybody worries about the same thing with sort of consolidation, that the idea would be, you know, we would worry that restaurants, if a whole bunch of neighborhood restaurants and retail shops fail, and then just the big guys, the Amazons and Walmarts and other, you know, big box retailers, Home Depots of the world, thrive during this, that you might have less competition, which is less good for the economy, and you know, less ability for people to start businesses and build wealth and do all the great things that help their communities. So that's one of the big questions, I think, of what's going to come out in the aftermath, you know, knock wood, once we have gotten this pandemic under control and the economy back on its feet again, will we see some dramatic decline in business dynamism? And we can only hope that what policymakers have been doing here will be enough to preserve, you know, as much of that as possible.
Oh, you can see so many things, I mean, at least for now, going online, and whether that will stay or whether, you know, people will go back to going shopping when they can feel safe about it.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there's also some opportunities in that. You know, we've seen people start businesses online that are small businesses that we've seen. I mean, certainly in my neighborhood, and I'm sure in yours, a lot of restaurants and other retailers have adapted. Some of them have survived and adapted and been able to change the way that they serve customers and maintain that relationship with them. And others haven't. And I think, you know, hopefully it's not just a case where the biggest and most connected companies are able to do that. Hopefully it's a case where, you know, even very small businesses, you know, mom and pop shops with one or two employees are able to hang on.
And what about help for state and local governments? I mean, they can't deficit spend the way the federal government can. Are they helped by this package?
There's a lot in here. More than $300 billion in the proposal for state and local governments that would, you know, help them avoid layoffs and particularly in education, but also in other government services, which was another lesson, by the way, of the 2009 crisis, that they did not do enough to help mitigate state and local layoffs. And they continued for years sort of holding down the job market. That's going to be a big fight. Because Republicans in Congress do not like the idea of sending aid to states and cities, even ones that are Republican-run states. And so I think that that was a big sticking point in December. It's why it ended up not being included in the bill, because Democrats and Republicans couldn't agree on it. And we will see if it remains sort of a big impediment this time, enough to force Democrats to pass this with no Republican votes at all.
Well, thank you, Jim Tankersley, for joining us on Radio Times, getting us up to speed on such an important issue. Thanks a lot.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. He covers economics and tax policy for the New York Times, and his book, published last year, is The Riches of the Land, the Untold True Story of America's Middle Class. And coming up after this very short break, we'll be talking about climate change and what the incoming Biden administration wants to do about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking about a series of challenges facing the incoming Biden-Harris administration and their plans to address them, and we conclude with the environment. President-elect Biden is reportedly going to re-enter the Paris Climate Agreement and cancel the Keystone XL pipeline project. He made the environment a centerpiece of his presidential campaign. Well, he's got his work cut out for him after the Trump administration administration dismantled many of the country's environmental policies, and after NASA reported that 2020 was the hottest year on record. We asked Justin Werlin to join us. He's a Washington, D.C.-based senior correspondent for Time, covering climate change and the intersection of policy, politics, and society. Justin Werlin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, you can join us, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Justin, let's begin with the Paris Climate Agreement or Climate Accord. When is the U.S. going to get back in on this agreement?
So the president-elect has signaled that he's going to sign an executive order on day one tomorrow, saying that the U.S. is back. It's about a 30-day process, so it's pretty easy for the U.S. to re-enter. The bigger question is, you know, by the end of the year, the U.S. needs to communicate a plan to really signal that it's back, and so that's something that'll play out over months. But in terms of actually getting back in, it's a 30-day process.
Wow. And will the world welcome us back?
Yeah, I mean, I think the world is thrilled that the U.S. is back. I mean, there's no question that Joe Biden and, you know, having a president who understands the science of climate change is a very welcome development. I do think there are going to be big questions about whether the U.S. can kind of waltz back into the role of global leader that it has played in the past, particularly under the Obama administration. So, you know, as I alluded to earlier, there's this plan that the U.S. needs to communicate by the end of the year that will really signal where is the U.S. going, to what degree is the U.S. really committing to spending money on addressing climate change and to prioritizing the issue. And I think that's where the world is going to have a lot of questions.
And what about the Keystone XL pipeline project? He reportedly wants to cancel that. How much of it was built? What do you think is the significance of that?
Well, I mean, there was a good deal of it has been built, and there's a lot of money that has been spent on it already. I think the big significance, though, is just the symbolism, right? This is a project that the Obama administration spent a considerable amount of time sort of going back and forth, trying to figure out what to do with it. And I think the sort of conventional wisdom is that the Obama administration, wanted to approve it, but ultimately decided for messaging reasons that it wasn't something they should do. However, it was something they spent a lot of time thinking about. And here we have on day one, Joe Biden saying no. It's a huge signal that he's taking this issue seriously.
So literally whatever construction that will stop, that the trucks will go home and it will be dismantled? Do we know?
Well, it's interesting, right? Because this is a project that has, it's even after it's been canceled, it's been brought back to life. And, you know, we have, I'm not quite sure exactly what the sort of, whether the builders are going to, hope for a change in 4 years or what exactly will happen with the, existing infrastructure that's been built. But, I don't see how it comes back, but I wouldn't be surprised if they were, just hoping somehow there's a chance that it's revived.
I do want to focus on what the incoming Biden administration wants to do, especially related to the environment and climate. But is there an easy answer to what the Trump administration was able to do to dismantle environmental policies?
Yeah, well, they really went through and reversed just about anything and everything they could get their hands on, which is to say a lot, because the Obama administration really relied on regulations that were, just could be reversed by the Trump administration. There is, a good point that a lot of people would make, which is that they're a lot of the regulations that the Trump administration targeted, they weren't exactly successful. A lot of it's been tied up in courts. A lot of the sort of work that has backed up their deregulation has been thought to be a little shoddy. And so it might be, that some of their work doesn't really hold up as much as the Trump administration might like. But, just from the outset, there is a lot, because they targeted more than 100 climate regulations.
So you see the Biden administration essentially going to court to fight this stuff out?
Well, I think it's a complicated process. I mean, some of these things are already in court, you know, tied up by environmental groups that have sued. Some of it is a process that they can just initiate. I mean, it's a process of basically studying the issue, building up the evidence to show that, in fact, the Trump administration's work to deregulate doesn't comport with the law or isn't in the best interest. And so what the administration will have to do is just come up with new evidence, open that evidence up for comment and feedback, and then that allows them to create these new regulations or bring back these regulations. And of course, they could also pursue the courts, but that's I think it's more going to be a process of regulating within the administration.
NASA reported that 2020 was the hottest year on record. And we also are very well aware of all the weather extremes, the droughts, the fires, the floods, you know, temperature records that were broken around the world. I think the insurance costs were something like $95 billion. I mean, how much do you think that just, you know, paying for the cleaning up, the destruction of towns and even parts of cities will be persuasive in trying to address the threat of climate change?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, I think the there is already growing concern among investors and among insurers and reinsurers, you know, the reinsurance being the people who insure the insurance companies, about this growing climate risk. You know, it's interesting, about a year ago, I had a conversation with Brian Deese, who was the head of sustainable investment at BlackRock. He's now Biden's chief economic advisor. And he was telling me, he told me about his concern, you know, overseeing investment at BlackRock about the risk posed to the mortgage industry by you know, homes that are in flood zones or at risk of wildfire, and how that hasn't been captured, right? And how, you know, when the world wakes up to these risks, it's going to cause a lot of alarm. And so I think for people in the know who are thinking about these issues, it's quite persuasive. I think the question is, to what degree does the world wake up to this? You know, to what degree are everyday people thinking about this? Because once they do, I think there is a really strong persuasive argument in that vein.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Justin Warland. He's a Washington, D.C.-based senior correspondent for Time. He covers climate change and the intersection of policy, politics, and society. The third of three guests in this hour, where we're taking a look at the incoming Biden administration and in this segment, what they want to do to address the threat, the problem of climate change. And again, you can join us. Any questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I know, Justin, candidate Biden was making the argument that climate change, and I think you've written about this as well, really touches everything. We have everything from the economy to the infrastructure to the insurance industry, as you just mentioned, to health, to immigration. Looking at the team that he's assembled, is that his approach going forward?
Yeah, I think that that's exactly, I have written about that, and I think that's exactly right. My perception is yes. I mean, I say this as a, you know, it's sort of an interesting thing I noted as the announcements about the nominations were coming out is, frankly, how many people I'd spoken to from his cabinet in the past year, right? And it's not necessarily people you'd expect. I just alluded to Brian Deese, who's his chief economic advisor. I talked to Janet Yellen last year, who is his treasury nominee. People like, you know, even someone you wouldn't expect, you know, like his USDA, his agriculture nominee. These are all people who are thinking about climate. You know, it may not be the primary thing they've worked on, but it's something that is very much on top of mind for all of them. And I expect it will be at least a part of their portfolio, even in agencies that aren't climate related agencies per se.
Has Biden and his environmental team, have they embraced any part of the Green New Deal?
So, you know, the Green New Deal is an interesting sort of as a resolution that was proposed in Congress is something that the Biden team has tried to walk away from in many ways as a sort of phrase. However, when you look at the actual substance of their plans, which was essentially to spend $2 trillion on climate-related spending that would also invigorate the economy, it looks a lot like a Green New Deal. So, you know, I think I would answer the question in short to say they would say no. And I would say, just from a sort of like analysis perspective, yes, they have. I mean, they really have embraced the principles of the Green New Deal.
Just not saying those words, right?
Just not saying those words, exactly.
Well, I know that he, meaning Joe Biden, incoming President Joe Biden, wants the U.S. electric grid to be carbon free by the year 2035. Do you think that's doable, Justin?
I think it is technically doable. It is, and perhaps politically doable as well. But it is definitely more difficult politically than it is technically. It requires huge investment right away. It also requires rules and targets that are a little tricky to get Republican buy-in for. Here in 2021. So technically doable, but it is a steep, steep challenge.
And how about the connection between the environment and jobs? I know that was something that Biden talked about on the campaign trail. Do you see evidence of trying to connect those two dots going forward?
Yeah, well, I think what the administration has signaled, what Biden has signaled, even last week when he was rolling out his plan for spending on COVID, he said, and coming up next in February is my economic spending plan, which will also be a climate spending plan. And so I think what we'll see, next month is discussion about how we can create, how the U.S. can create jobs in green industries, things like retrofitting homes to be energy efficient, things like building energy, electric vehicle charging stations across the country. These are all things that can create a huge number of jobs and also green the economy. So I think it's coming probably within the matter of weeks.
Interesting. What about natural gas and fracking? And this is, such an important issue to Pennsylvania, which has a big industry largely in the western part of the state. Where does Biden come down on that?
Yeah, this is again an area. It's sort of similar to the Green New Deal, and that he tries to sort of have it both ways. I think what we're going to see is a focus on pushing clean energy, and there's going to be some potential regulation of the oil and gas industry, things like methane regulations, which. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas that leaks in the process of fracking. But I don't think there's going to be a wholesale, push to eliminate fracking, as Trump suggested on the campaign. I think really the focus of the Biden administration is going to be about how can we promote clean energy. And then, of course, that will have the effect of pushing out natural gas and fracking eventually, but the focus is going to be more on promoting clean energy than trying to regulate away a fossil fuel, particularly natural gas.
And what kind of help for disadvantaged communities, often inner city communities who have really borne, although not always, borne the brunt of the fossil fuel or chemical industry pollution?
That's a very good question. I mean, this is something that Biden has talked about and has put in his plan. It's one of those things that's going to come down to that tricky legislative process, right? Because spending has to come out of Congress. It's something that I think everybody expects. There's going to be some focus on transitioning communities that are dependent on fossil fuels, and also dealing with communities that have been polluted by fossil fuels and figuring out a way to fund their rejuvenation. But I think it's really just too hard to say what's going to emerge from that sort of, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars here, what's going to emerge from that sort of behind the scenes discussion.
Justin, we're almost out of time here, but do you expect then some vigorous debate in Congress about what to do going forward to deal with climate change and the environment?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I mean, I think it's just worth noting that, you know, in December, amid that COVID stimulus package, there was $35 billion in funding for clean energy, which, you know, wasn't the biggest headline out of that. But that's a lot of money. And, yeah. You know, there wasn't really much opposition on the Hill for that. So I think it's just telling because there's a lot of interest on the Hill, I think, on both sides of the aisle for some of these measures. And I think it's going to be vigorously debated. I think it's going to be an issue that, while has been on the sidelines for years, this past 4 years, it's something that's going to bubble up very shortly.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us, Justin Moreland. Thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Senior correspondent for Time, covering climate change and the intersection of policy, politics, and society. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. And you can always and also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.